In this session, we're following in the path of Shen Nong and seeing what we can discover about the properties of herbs by tasting them. Boris Bernansky, one of the founders of Dragon Blood Balm, guides us through this process of tasting the herbs and observing their effects. If you want to follow along, we'll be tasting some Huang Qi, astragalus root, and some Du Zhong, Eucomia cortex, to see how they differ. But this is a fun one, so let's get right into it with Boris. I think this is a really interesting concept, this idea of learning herbs by tasting them, because I've taught herbs classes in school, and we did it the boring way, where you just go through Bensky and memorize the functions. How do we go about learning herbs by tasting them?
So it's pretty straightforward. Essentially, you taste them. There are a couple of guidelines that are going to help us to understand how we're interacting with the herbs. And I'll just tell you a little bit about how I kind of discovered this method. I don't want to say discovered it. It's just that I found a teacher, which I'll mention in a few minutes, who taught it to me. But I was always interested in tasting the herbs. I remember, like in school, when the teacher would pass around samples, I would always kind of nibble on it. And one time they were passing around Bado, and the teacher was like, "Boris, don't taste that."
Yeah.
Before it got to me, I was like, "Okay, thanks, thanks for the warning." I didn't.
Yeah, because I was gonna say I had a friend in school who was all about, "I'm gonna taste the herbs," or he's like, "I don't feel comfortable giving herbs to a patient unless I've tasted them myself first." Mm-hmm. And then he like took a large dose of Bado. I'm like, "I'm surprised you didn't kill yourself."
Did he have any reaction?
I think he felt either really cold or really hot, something mm-hmm. like that. I don't.
So I mean that. Like, I can respect your friend's, work ethic, so to speak. But, you know, obviously, it's worth looking at the warnings of the other teachers, right? You know, see what experience they've had. It's like, oh, if this is going to give you the runs really bad, maybe it's not something to try unless you really need that.
Yeah, and that's maybe something we should mention. Are there safety concerns with this? Where, like, I think we say that Shen Nong lived tasting the 100 herbs. He also died tasting the 100 herbs.
Yeah. Well, he poisoned himself. I forget the exact story, but Shen Nong was like a kind of a spirit immortal type dude. He had a clear body, so he was able to see what the herbs did. So he was able to see where the poisons went. So he was able to cure himself each time.
Okay, kind of like we talk about the window. I usually heard the window in his stomach, but he could actually see where it's going through the channels and which Zongfu or.
I wasn't there, but the way I heard the story, it made it sound like you could see where it goes and what it does. You know, Shen Nong's a great transition because if we look at the Huangdi Neijing, it tells us specifically what the different flavors of herbs are supposed to do. And we learned this in school, but I feel like it's either glossed over or only mentioned like in herbs one and then never really mentioned again. Or, you know, we memorize the flavors of herbs just as a property, but never as a guide to how to use them. So this is an article that's written by my teacher, Julianne Nugent-Head, and it's available for free online. You can see the URL there, and if there are show notes, we can put them there. But she has a quote here from the Huangdi Neijing, and it is essentially the guide for herbalism, so to speak. So we can see here, acrid can disperse, can make things move. We have the Chinese here, if anybody can read it. Sweet can build, can slow, can harmonize. Bitter can drain, can dry, can make firm. And notice that they're using the word can here. It's not guaranteeing any of these things. It's just it can do those things. Sour can gather and can astringe. Salty can descend, can soften. And bland can leach and can benefit. And here the translation is create flow. So that's like, you know, gently move. So using that as a guideline, when we taste the herbs, we can sort of think about what to look for. So like what flavors do we taste? And based on that, we can create a theory as to what they might do. And the flavor is only one aspect of it. So we taste the herb and first you experience it in your mouth. You experience it in your nose to see what the smell is like, to see if it's very fragrant, if it hangs out for a long time. And then we pay attention. Do we start to feel things in our body? Like a certain herb like huangbai, if we drink it, take my word for it since I've experienced it, is it kind of goes down real quick, kind of percolates down. Kind of if you take a shot of whiskey,
yeah,
you feel the heat travel down and it hits the stomach, or if you take some bitters or something, you know, it you can tell where it goes. And likewise, huangbai in particular, you can feel it really hitting that stomach and even going lower. Oftentimes you'll start feeling gurgling in the intestines or something like this. And the same is for other herbs.
like when we say that Huang Bai is bitter, the bitter has a downward direction, and we say that Huang Bai goes to the lower Zhao, that's not just a theoretical concept. That's something when we taste the herb, we can feel that bitterness going down and we can feel it being directed to the lower Zhao and
precisely
clearing out our vaginal discharge or whatever.
Exactly. No more vaginal discharge. However, Huang Lian, like really similar flavor in the mouth, in my opinion, but it doesn't do that whole thing. It kind of hangs out here, and the bitter lasts a lot longer. And it's interesting. So like, and then Huang Dian is used for clearing heart heat and heat in the upper jaw and like agitation and all these things. And so, you know, we look at what our experience is, and then we also look at, no reason not to look at Bensky. You know, they have great information here, and they have the experience of all these teachers throughout time and what they've found that the herbs do. So I'm not saying we should ignore that by any means, but we taste it, experience it ourselves, and then we can also understand the functions much better. Because it doesn't, like Huang Bai doesn't clear damp heat. Huang Bai is bitter and cold and goes to the lower area, and therefore it clears damp heat. It's not like it magically does it somehow. It's because of these kind of properties. And you know, Huang Bai is every one I've tasted is pretty bitter, so it's like that doesn't vary plant to plant. But I'm not sure. Let's talk about like a food we eat. So if we, Julianne, actually the teacher that I mentioned, she often mentions the metaphor of apples. It's not a metaphor. It's like example of apples. If we have a green apple, like a Granny Smith, and compare it to like a Fuji or a Gala. It's quite a different taste, but they're both apples. So like depending where the apple grows, the season, the type of apple, even though they're both the same fruit, they're going to be wildly different flavor and therefore probably are going to do different things in the body.
Yeah, like a tart versus a sweet sort of thing.
And
yeah.
So like if you have a recipe and it calls for green apples, but you only have red apples, do you not make your apple pie or do you just adjust the sugar? So, you know, this is what we have to think about, in my opinion, when we're using herbs and tasting herbs. So if you're trying to build up someone's qi and we're trying to use a sweet herb, but we're tasting it and it doesn't have a lot of sweetness, either we can't expect it to be a great qi tonic per se, or maybe this specific one needs a higher dose or something like that. I mean, what do you think? Have you tasted different herbs at all? I mean, you have that huang qi sitting there. Like, I'm sure you've drank in herbs as medicine.
Yes. I'm not sure. Sometimes I would do it like in class. I would always, when we would go through that first week where we'd look at all the different flavors, actually the first thing I would do is I would make muffins. I found a really good muffin recipe that has all five flavors. It's like a ginger, green tea, orange peel.
That muffin. Sounds fantastic.
And so I'd be like, can you taste, it has some cranberries in it for the sour. It's like, can you taste the bitterness of the tea and the acridness of the ginger? Sometimes like that. Sometimes we do specific examples where it's like, if I want you to taste bitter, I'll make some Huang Lian Jie Di Tang, and people be like, oh, this is the most bitter thing. They run and spit it out because it's so bitter. I'm not sure I've ever actually like my friend who took the Ba Do. I think he was very Buddhist. He would actually sit down and meditate with the herbs. I've never gone that far as to be like, can I see where this is traveling in my body? But I have tasted things, and some of them, and to me, it's almost like some of them have like, I'm not sure I can identify the flavor, but like Huang Qi, I think, has a very distinct smell and a very distinct taste that if somebody is cooking Buzhong Yichi Tong in the other room, I can tell what it is versus like if you taste Dong Gui, it almost to me, it has like a soapy flavor. Oh, like some of these are very distinct. Some of them just taste generally like herbs. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. I definitely noticed that, and then I was thinking about it, and I realized it's probably that so many formulas, let's say, have Dong Gui, that we have this experience of, oh, this is what herbs taste like. Oh, that's actually Dong Gui.
Yeah, or sometimes in class, like when we were in school, we would get the herb samples, but they pack them all together in one box. So sometimes people would try to smell the herbs, but it's like they've been packed together for so long, it just smells vaguely Chinese. It doesn't actually, you don't always get the distinct smell of it.
I had that experience actually today when I was cooking my doujiang. I'd ordered it. It was packed with rogue, and I was like smelling it. I'm like, damn, this smells like cinnamon. Hopefully that kind of those essential oils boiled off a little bit. But actually, you'd mentioned the cautions. So I think it's a fair point to make that we do need to be cautious, especially if we don't have guidance. But I mean, a lot of the herbs that are prescribed are safer than we think. especially if you're not taking it long periods of time. And a really great, actually, way to reference that is if we look at the original categorization of herbs in the Shennong Bansao. I don't know if you know your listeners are too familiar with it, but they, rather than organizing it on function, they organized it on like upper, lower, and middle herbs, upper, middle, and lower herbs. And essentially, that's an organization based on strength of action, of strength of function, where the lower herbs you can take for only a short time and are necessary for severe diseases, whereas the upper herbs you can take for a long time, and often they have like this added function of lengthens the life and makes you light. That being said, there are some herbs that are in the upper category that people might feel very uncomfortable about and might throw out the whole baby with the bathwater. But for example, Jusha is in an upper category. So that's kind of potentially problematic, especially if people don't know how it can be used safely. But for the most part, most of the herbs in the upper category are going to be things that are safe to use for long periods of time. And, you know, we don't necessarily, we lose that a little bit in the current Materia Medicas. They don't have that categorization. And I think that's a bit of a loss because it kind of hides from us the potential versatility of the herb. They do give you that range of dosages, though, which is kind of useful. Another thing to consider is that if we look at the Shanghanlin, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, I feel like I didn't learn it in school, I learned it outside of school, that the dosages of things in the Shanghanlin are significantly higher than what we use based on Bensky, for example.
Yeah, I was going to say certain things always surprise me. Like you wouldn't think like Shergao is sometimes a very large yep. dosage or...
yeah, there's like over 100 grams.
Shuhuang especially. Yeah, even like Chai Hu. Like I just saw a note today where it's like, here's Chai Hu in the Shanghanlin is this. Modern practitioners reduce it by a half or a third mm-hmm. or something like that.
So yeah, I think full dose Shao Chai Hu Tang, I can't remember the exact dosage, but it's like... well over 70 grams of Chai Hu, maybe over 100 grams, whereas modern practitioners will seldom go over 18. And for example, there's 45 grams of Guizhi in Guizhi Tang, as per the Shanghanlin. In Bensky, it's like, you know, recommended dosage is 9 to 12 grams or something like this. So if we're expecting big, strong effects, those are the dosages we should be considering. And I think by tasting herbs and experiencing them, we kind of can see like, oh, okay, let's say if you drink Huanglian at 20 grams, like we're doing 20 grams of herbs today, you're going to notice a big effect. And you're like, okay, that was really strong. But if you drink, let's see, what wouldn't do much? If you drank, I don't know, Longgu at 20 grams, you're not going to feel much. Like that's like that much of that stuff. And it's a pretty, you know, I mean, if you have a tendency to have issues, like maybe it'll give you some constipation or something, but you know, you're not going to feel too much. So like there is places to use a 3-gram herb, like Wu Weizi or Huanglian or Ganjiang. You can easily do something real with like 3 to 6 grams, but some herbs you kind of need a bigger dose, in my opinion and in my experience anyway. So the main thing is pay attention to those like harsh expellents or herbs that are in the forbidden category. Or if you have the Shennong Bansao as a reference, just if it's in a lower category, maybe don't start tasting a big dose of it, or maybe consider not tasting it unless you have some presentation where you potentially could benefit from it.
Yeah, because I was thinking, like, on the one hand, there's like obviously there's some obvious toxic mm-hmm. herbs that we should be careful with. But I guess I was also thinking in terms of like, again, sometimes for class, I would make Huanglian Jiedutong just so we can taste the bitter flavor. And I feel like even if you've been diagnosed with spleen qi deficiency, or even if you've been diagnosed with weakness deficiency cold in the middle, you can probably still taste a little bit of Huanglian Jiedutong just yeah. to taste it, and it probably won't kill you. Like as long as you're not taking a huge formula over a long period of time, just tasting the herb probably won't kill you, even if it would be contraindicated.
For sure.
In your normal
treatment. For sure. I think that's a really good point because, you know, we don't have to, it's like a sommelier, they don't drink a bottle of wine each time they taste the wine. Yeah. They taste it. So you taste it, you get a feeling for it in the body. It doesn't, like, it goes there, but, if there's very little of it, it's not going to do anything. Or it won't do much. So unless you're very fragile, some folks are very sensitive. Like, you know, the people who typically do really well with Japanese acupuncture, a small dose of herbs is going to make their qi move. Because this, you know, essentially it's making your cheat do something.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to ask you about. As we were talking about these large dosages, on the opposite of end of the spectrum, we have compo medicine where they use very small, not only like very light needling technique, they use very small dosages of herbs. Do you have an opinion on that?
I don't have a strong opinion. I definitely know some compo practitioners that I think are like very legitimate and are doing good work, like Nigel Dawes and some of his students out in New York that I've met and worked with. I personally don't resonate with that per se, and I haven't been able to get it to work the same way that I can get using a stronger dose to work. And I feel that when I write a big dose or a moderate dose or a dose I consider appropriate for the patient, I will see a change. And so there's not going to be like guessing. It's like, oh, is this maybe helping? It's like, no, this is either helping. If it's not doing anything at all, then we need to probably increase the dose, or it's hurting. And, you know, I hope that more often than not, I'm helping than I'm hurting or not doing anything. Kind of, but it kind of helps you to clarify your direction too, because if someone is taking like T pills, I don't know, 8 grams a day, I mean, 8 pills a day for 6 months and nothing happened, did the Chinese medicine not work, or was it the doses like so small that it wasn't going to do anything? And it also depends on the disease. Like I have pregnant patients, I'll write them, all right, take Zisu, 3 grams, just brew it as a tea and sip it throughout the day. That was their formula or something like that.
Yeah, I was going to say, how quickly should we notice results? Because I feel like I remember being in school and I had one fellow student and she was like, oh yeah, I've been taking Xiaoyaosan, but you know, sometimes herbs just take a while to work. I had to take Xiaoyaosan for 2 or 3 months before I noticed the difference. And I was kind of like, is that a real thing? Or does that just mean you weren't taking the right formula or you weren't taking the right dosage? Should we notice something the next day, the next week?
So in my experience, and I don't want to speak on behalf of my teachers, but a lot of practitioners I respect, for example, Andrew Nugent-Head and Julianne, Michael Peluso, he's kind of a big name in the Facebook teaching world. Like he does really great work with herbs. I would err on the side of within 2 weeks, you should definitely be noticing a change, probably sooner, because you should be prescribing something that's going to be effective for your patient and not wasting their time. So, you know, obviously there are conditions that take a long time to make a big difference, but like you should be clear on your direction. So especially if you're writing a formula that is either hot or cold, not super balanced, sometimes we'll have to write a formula that does like a little bit of this, a little bit of that, a little bit of that. And so the changes are going to be small because you're not using like I guess it's not hitting with a lot of momentum. It's kind of going in there and gently reorganizing things. But are you familiar with MicroGuard?
No.
All right. So there's this guy, Andrew Miles. He runs Botanical Biohacking. They have a podcast and a product line.
Yeah.
So they have this herbal pill MicroGuard, and they're these teeny tiny pills, and they work. You know, it's one of the only patents I keep in my pharmacy at my office, because you know when it's appropriate and I prescribe it, within 2 doses people are noticing a difference. You know, when I prescribe herbs, I mostly write raw herbs these days. I use Camo Pharmacy. They just do drop shipping for me. I'll write patients maybe a 6-day supply because I need them to report back whether or not there's a change. If like I never give them like a month of herbs and say, okay, come back to me in a month. Hopefully something has changed a little bit. And sometimes I'm on the phone with patients or like checking in with them and they're like, okay, I'm feeling this and this. I'm like, okay, take that herb out. Like, and I'll modify the formula like on the fly. They'll take a picture of their formula and I'll be like, okay, it sounds like this formula was too sweet for you and too cloying. So let's take out one of those dates and cut that black disc dihuang in half. And, you know, tell me how you're feeling the next day. And then they'll be like, okay, that's much better. So I expect a change within a week, especially if I'm treating a problem that's loud enough that we would notice a change. If I'm treating amenorrhea, maybe it's different.
Yeah, so not necessarily 100% improvement.
No, not at all.
In a week, but we should notice some sort of change. And I don't know, for me, I almost feel like some sort of change, even if it's not entirely positive, is better than no change at all. Because at least then you get some feedback and you know that something is happening. So if they said, oh, I got really nauseous and I had diarrhea, that's better than nothing happened at all.
Exactly, exactly. And that's actually, I'm just going to keep coming back to my tasting thing. because I'm going to use every opportunity to make points. but that's a really good point. So if you know what you're prescribing, you know what the directionality of the herbs are, and which you can tell by tasting, you can almost tell right away, you'll know like, oh, they're feeling nauseous. That means for some reason the formula is going back up. Either it moves up too much on its own, and we need to see if there's too many light herbs in there or something like this, or there's some dampness stuck in the middle, and so they're just bouncing off of it, coming up. You know what I mean? So if you know what your herbs are doing, like you know the directionality that they're supposed to move, like how they act in the body, then it's much easier to deal with like, oh, I felt this from taking that formula. You can be like, okay, that's that herb. That's too much of that. Let's cut it down. Versus if you just know it harmonizes liver and spleen, what do you do with that? It made me nauseous. Like, okay, so what does that mean? I mean, there's probably a good answer of what you can do with it. I don't know. I'm just saying, from my experience, for me, it's much easier to think, okay, even shiatsu, if it's making someone nauseous, I would consider first like looking at the sweet herbs, or maybe, you know, because that could, maybe that's affecting that middle jiao, or increasing some of that baijiu and decreasing a little bit of that dangwei.
Should we go ahead and taste something?
That sounds great. All right.
I got my huangqi. I recently switched over to granules just because I'm lazy and I don't have an herbal pharmacy in my living room anymore. So,
hey, granules work. Granules work well if they're used well.
Yeah, and this is something I'm kind of excited because it's like huangqi. I've tasted just straight huangqi before, so I feel like I have some idea how what it's supposed to taste like. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious to see if this tastes the same. I got my little latte frother that I use because I'm too lazy to stir.
That's reasonable. It's hard. Sometimes it's hard to get those sweet herbs to dissolve. So I'm brewing up this huangqi. I got it. This is the huangqi I use in Dragon Blood Balm. So I haven't actually tasted it, so I'm curious.
And this one, at least when I looked in the granules, I noticed it looked a lot more yellow than what I'm used to. I was always confused about huangqi. Never looked very huang to me, but...
So I guess mine looks kind of yellow. Looks like something yellow. Sorry, slurping loudly.
Yeah, this tastes a little bit different than what I'm used to. Mm-hmm. I feel like I might be tasting some of the fillers in it.
Yeah, I think with granules, sometimes that's the case. And for example, when I was, I've kind of participated in Michael Peluso's teaching platforms, and one of the things they recommend is you starting off on, and I don't want to put words in their mouth, so, but still, that group, they oftentimes recommend doses starting at like 8 grams as a single dose, so like 8 grams twice a day to start. So, you know, we're expecting that's 16 grams a day times 5. So that is the equivalent of about 80 grams of herbs a day, which is a fairly big dose compared to what a lot of people will write. You know, most people will write maybe 5 herbs at 9 grams each, or maybe 10 herbs at 9 grams each, and then split that over 2 or 3 days versus that much in one day. So I think the dose is really important. So especially with granules, with the filler as a consideration, we got to dose up.
Yeah, and when I was at symposium, I talked to one of the guys at the Meiwei booth, and he was saying that, like, yeah, if for certain long-term things, I might follow the instructions on the bottle that says, like, 3 scoops 3 times a day. But when it comes to, like, if you really want to knock out phlegm with Ching Chi Hua Tan Tong, he will often go much higher than mm-hmm. that. So I think that's another thing where sometimes people just go with the bottle, but we can still go higher. Yeah.
I mean, when I had COVID, I think I took about 50 grams of granules a day. For 3 days and I was done, but
yeah,
but I was taking like 10 grams every 2 hours.
So we're doing huangqi, astragalus root. This is in the category herbs that tonify qi. It's also called bei qi, northern qi. What do we know about huangqi? It's sweet in flavor. Mm-hmm. It tonifies qi. It's good for securing the exterior and stopping sweating. It's good for tonifying the lung qi, tonifying the spleen qi. It has a very strong upward direction mm-hmm. to lift things upwards. Also, I think can promote urination.
Interesting.
Should we be able to taste all of these things in the herbs?
Well, we can probably taste some of it. I definitely taste the sweetness. Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure if you taste the sweetness.
Yeah.
I can't remember. Does it have an acrid flavor at all too? Here, let me pull it up here. Because I'm feeling a little bit of dryness in my mouth. So I'm wondering if it has any drying. But as far as like the lightness goes, I definitely feel like it's kind of, the flavor is lingering in my nose. Like it's like mm-hmm. it's traveling up through my nose. Whereas some herbs, you know, you kind of feel it going down. Here, I definitely feel like the smell and the flavor hang out in the nose. So I have a friend who he can take a sip of something and he's like, oh, it goes to my left pinky finger. I can't do that. But typically, the more balanced you are, the less it's going to disbalance you. So like the more illness you might have, the more easily you get swayed one way or another with herbs or with anything. That's why, you know, if your Zhang Qi is strong, wind is not going to invade you like that. And you're going to be able to walk around people who are coughing without necessarily getting sick. Likewise, you can eat something weird and it not do too much. So I think with herbs, it's similar. So if we're tasting it and we're in a relatively healthy state, but not practicing and, you know, becoming very aware of our bodies, it can be a little bit hard to perceive some of the more subtle things. But at least, like, if we focus on the flavor and the smell, we can definitely see it's light. I mean, the texture of the fluid is also, it doesn't feel heavy, it's not sticky. So even though it is tonifying, it's not like a sticky tonifying, like if you were to eat some honey or have something like that.
Yeah.
So we can consider that it will benefit the spleen, and like it's not going to encumber it with dampness.
Yeah, it's not going to clog it down like a shudi could or something like that.
So like when we're thinking about something like shudi, for example, it's a great example. It's thick and it has like a weight to it. And even the color of it, the liquid comes out black. Yeah. I mean, this is hushu, right? That has shudi and hushu. So those are heavy substances. So we can probably consider that even though they're sweet, they're not going to tonify the qi. They're probably going to tonify the blood, the more kind of yin aspect of things. Where, like, if we look at this, it's super light in color. It's not super spicy, so, like, okay, probably not going to tonify the yang. And it's not, like, heavy and light simultaneously, so it's probably going to more affect the qi, so to speak. But, you know, it can be used to raise yang, like, you know, in rectal prolapse. In, like, Bujong Yichitang, it's considered something as lifting up the yang.
I was going to say, I feel like when I've had this raw, it's a little bit sharper. I feel like my granules is maybe a little bit more muted or maybe a little bit more muddy. So again, that might just be the filler, the other stuff in it.
It could be the filler, for sure. I mean, I've had a much stronger taste in Huang Qi. So the source I use for Dragon Blood Balm, they try to wildcraft their herbs and get the highest quality possible, so long and make sure it's clean. So I've had more concentrated tasting Huang Qi in the past, and I'm looking at the cut I have here. It's relatively small if you compare it to those tongue depressors.
Okay, yeah. I was going to say normally, yeah, they look like popsicle sticks or really long strips.
So those tongue depressors are typically about that wide compared to this. And so I think with that age, they can build a lot more flavor. So the one I'm tasting is quite light and really quite yummy. I don't taste anything bad in it. I would definitely like... If I wasn't concerned about it making me too jittery, and I haven't experienced that necessarily, but you know, just because of what the books say, this is delicious. I would love to drink this on a daily basis.
Yeah, and I was going to say this, like, I think of it as a little lightness, like it's kind of like that light and refreshing, like you would drink like a flowery tea during summer, that kind of light refreshing versus like a, I don't know, something heavy. I'm trying to think of something like...
I mean, I think even dates, like if you chop them up and boil them, it comes out like it's like a syrupy, heavy, it's a heavy drink.
Yeah, because I'm almost thinking like in the summer when you eat like an angel food cake with strawberries, that's much lighter, more appropriate with the summer, or like a nice, like a light soup versus like a heavy, a hearty stew that you eat during the winter, or a heavy chocolate cake, which would kind of
exactly.
weigh you more down. This is more on that like light, refreshing side that it's... It's not going to bog me down.
But as we're drinking it, I mean, I've had, this is about an ounce. I definitely feel like a little bit lighter in the head and a little bit excited. And I don't know, maybe you're just a very exciting person to talk to.
I don't know about that.
Or maybe I'm convincing myself. But I definitely feel like a...
Yeah, but as you said that, I was thinking, like, I definitely feel it more up in my head. I don't feel it down in my stomach, whereas, like, when I started drinking the wine, like, I felt that going down in my stomach. This, I definitely feel it more, like, up into my head, maybe in the upper body, but definitely not, like, something sinking into my stomach like I just ate a sweet brownie or something. I guess I'm really into chocolate tonight. Like, ate something heavy or drank a stout beer or something like that where you feel it go down into your stomach.
Exactly. That's pretty much my experience, and that's pretty good. So, like, if we have the similar experience, even the tastes are a little bit different, more or less they're doing similar things as far as the qi goes. Like, the taste It's similar. It's sweet, but yours is a little muddy. But the action of the herb, it's still relatively a young herb. It goes up, and we can taste that from just like a little few sips. How many spoons did you put in, by the way?
I think I put in 3 spoons. So I think that's usually what they say here.
So that's like 15 grams.
Which I feel is like Huang Qi is one of those ones that goes up to like 150 grams.
It does, But also sometimes like it'll be like 12 grams or like 9 grams. Sometimes I get really surprised because I'll see formulas. Like right now I'm reading this book. I don't know if you've heard of this doctor, Dr. Tan Xunyan. She's, hold on, fact check myself. I need to make sure I'm pronouncing her name right. Tan Yunchen. Sorry.
Tan Yunchen, okay.
So she's the first female physician to have written a book that we have access of. So she was a Ming Dynasty doctor. And she mostly, you know, she took care of a lot of women because she was a female. And in the Confucian times, they weren't like really allowed to interact with men for the most part.
Was this trans? Who trans? Was this Sabine Welms?
Lorraine Wilcox translated her book. And it's really great. It has like really great case studies and discussions. And then recently, I think her name is Lisa C. She wrote a fictionalized history of her life. So it's like a novel.
Okay, yeah.
It's like a Chinese medicine novel. It's really great.
Yeah, no, because I remember that book coming up and it looked like it was really insightful because they kind of said that a lot of male practitioners at the time didn't necessarily have the same kind of access to female patients. It's like they had to take their pulse through the window and stuff like that. So this actually gave us a lot of insight on women's health conditions. So anyway, that just popped into my head. Go on with what you were originally saying.
So like, yes, that's one of the reasons the book is so fun and like fascinating. And the novel is actually really good. My wife and I listened to the audiobook together and we loved it. We couldn't turn it off. Where was I going? Right. So she writes really small doses. She'll write like, you know, 6 to 10 herbs at 3 grams each, and the person takes it for like a week and they're better. So I think the better you are as a doctor, the less often maybe you need to use like a big heavy punch. But I'm not there where I can like just use like a tiny toothpick and poke someone once and then with herbs anyway, and have a big effect. With acupuncture, somehow I find it easier and I'm oftentimes able to be very minimal. But with herbs, I find that at least for now, I'm hoping maybe one day I can be like, okay, you need 0.5 gram of Baijiu and that's going to fix all your problems. That's the herb you need. But for now, I'm like, all right.
Yeah, I guess what I've come to prefer is a smaller number of herbs, but still using the large dosages. Like I don't like to over modify a formula. I feel like that just muddies the waters too much. But personally, I've never had success with that compo style formula. Whereas when I switched to like full Chinese doses, that's when I've seen the magical results.
I think the other thing with compo style herbal medicine is it's really important to get the diagnosis right. And that's why they spend a lot of time. They feel the pulse, they feel the abdomen, they look at the symptoms, they look at the tongue. I mean, we should all be doing this theoretically, but it's not just on interview. There's a lot of palpation. And when I followed, his name is Boris Shapiro. He was one of Nigel Dawes's like close students. When I followed him, he would oftentimes give like, here's a 2-day supply, and then he would have the person come back and then he would recheck the abdomen and look for confirmations that there has been a change. So the patient might not feel it at that point, but they're looking for a change right away in the qi of the person. And so then it's like this kind of slight, not modifying, because typically in compo you use pre-made granules, but you're just like switching the herbs. Maybe, you know, you want to liver qi stagnation formula, but no longer is it Jiawei Shaiyosan. Now you switch to Shaiyosan. Now maybe it's Chaihu Shugantang. So it's this constant like tick, 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 tick.
Yeah, that's really interesting because I know a lot of people who do their acupuncture like that, where it's like, oh, I'll stick in a needle and then check the pulse to see if it changed. Now what point do I need next? And they'll stick a needle in and they get that instant feedback through the pulse. And I feel like normally we can't do that with herbs. We can't just like drink some herbs and immediately my tongue changes color or something like that. We usually don't have that kind of feedback. So that's really interesting.
That's what I try to imitate sometimes with my patients that are sensitive to things. I'll give them a formula and they'll brew it up. And then based on their reaction, I'll modify that like the next dose and the next dose until we can find something that they can take for a long enough time before they come to me the next time and I can just write a whole new formula if needed. But yeah, it's much easier, I think, to go with fewer herbs, because at least if you get it wrong, you know what you were doing, because you were like, okay, we are supporting the blood. All right, that wasn't the right choice. Well, let's clear dampness.
Yeah, and sometimes I felt like, again, when that diagnosis was good and I was using those herbs, then some of those extraneous modifications weren't necessary. Like sometimes I feel people start, they want to chase after every little symptom. Like, oh, I should put in some Xin Yi Hua to help with their
nose.
Yeah, to help with their allergies, and put in some Chuan Chong to help with their headache, and put in this. And sometimes, like, if I just take that out and focus on treating the root with those herbs, then those branch symptoms just automatically resolve. So
I typically agree with you. Like I aim for that, to be smart enough to know what the root is and to be brave enough to ignore the branches. Sometimes, you know, you got to treat the branches, but oftentimes they're just distracting.
Is this how you studied herbs in school?
No, I studied at PCOM. So, my teachers in PCOM were actually really good. I like them. And we did mostly Lebensky method because that's what we needed to learn. We needed for the tests. I tasted the herbs. I would just chew on them. And for some reason, I couldn't figure out that, oh, if we're drinking them, we should boil them and taste them if we're going to bother tasting them. But I was already interested in trying to learn the herbs that way. So for me, tasting them and chewing on the herbs was almost a mnemonic versus a... it was a learning tool versus the way I learned the herbs. Does that make sense?
Okay, I see. Yeah. No, because I was just thinking that sometimes we say that herbal medicine is much more difficult to learn than acupuncture. And I mean, I think one reason is just you when you're in school, you experience a lot more acupuncture and you see it in the clinic a lot more, where you might not see herbal therapy used as much. But sometimes we say that acupuncture is a little bit easier to study because, like, you can touch the point, you can press it, you can practice locating on your friends, and so it's a little bit more real. Whereas a lot of times when you learn herbs, it's all in pinyin, it's all in Chinese, and you're just memorizing functions, and there's nothing really real about it. So I wonder how effective of a technique would this be? Would this make it real, or would it just be like, I'm spending all my free time cooking herbs, and I should really just hit the books?
Yeah, I mean, ideally you could do it concurrently. Like, I mean, we have how long are we in school? It's about 3 years, right? 3 to 5 years, depending on how you do it. But if there's 365 days in a year, so you can theoretically learn pretty much the whole materia medica, at least what we need to know for school, if you taste one herb a day for a year. Maybe you taste two herbs a day. I mean, you don't have to taste all of them, but like, I think it definitely makes it a much more experiential and easier to understand. So in school, I definitely had, you know, in school, I definitely kind of thought of herbs as really theoretical and tried to make them real for myself. But I was kind of frustrated because most of my supervisors in clinic weren't really clear on herbs or weren't clear on how to teach them to me. I mean, and just memorizing patterns and formulas didn't seem to work because typically most patients have like mixed patterns. If we want to stick to like the TCM model, like most of the patterns are mixed. Most people don't have just blood deficiency. They'll have blood deficiency and liver qi stagnation and dampness. And, you know, maybe they have some sort of blood stasis because of injuries or a C-section or something like this. So
I think especially in a modern Western clinic, it's very...
For sure. And so because of the complex patterns I was seeing myself, and I couldn't really match them well to the patterns I was learning, and there were no teachers showing me how to do it. As I mentioned, again, the TCM Hub guys, they do a really great job of making TCM-style Chinese medicine work. I don't consider myself to be like a student of that method, though I have sort of dabbled, and I think it's really great. I mostly study with the Nugent heads, and they have a different approach. I can talk about it in a little bit. But... once I started tasting herbs and really experiencing it in myself, it was really eye-opening. And then once I saw, like, I followed them in clinic and saw them writing formulas and saw patients getting better, I was like, oh, okay, it does work. You just need to see it work to be able to use it. Acupuncture is much easier. You can stick a needle in yourself and you're like, okay, look, my finger's twitching. Or, you know, you overdo it and you're like, oh, okay, I've drained my qi.
Yeah, I was going to say that, and that might be a thing that in school, not everybody always sees herbal medicine work while they're in school. So I could see that as well.
And I think it's a great detriment because it's so powerful and so useful. I'm very happy that I do herbs now. And I'm very sad when I see people say that herbs don't work or they don't, you know, things like that. Because they do, and I think they're far more powerful than acupuncture, potentially, if used right. The other reason I got really excited about this method was, I mean, this is, at this point, just a thought experiment, because I haven't yet to really apply it. But during COVID, ooh, nice pot.
Yeah, I was going to say, I got my heavy-duty traditional pot. I usually can't do this up without spilling. We'll see what happens. Should we try the Dujong, but say what you're going to say first.
Oh, you got a nice brew. Did you do 20 grams?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mine came out pretty light.
Maybe a little bit more. I think it might have been a little bit more, but not.
Maybe it's because you have a black t-shirt behind.
Tastes like bark.
Tastes like bark. I taste, maybe it's still a little bit of the huangqi in my mouth, but I taste a little sweetness. Let's see if that's going to get away.
Yeah, so we're doing Dujong, Eucomia cortex. This is the bark of a Chinese rubber tree.
Mm-hmm.
So it has some naturally occurring latex. So this is the one I'd always tell people, like, if you look at your sample, this isn't very high quality Dujong, but it's like, it's got that stuff in it. It's like you can stretch it apart. It looks like tendons, and maybe there's some doctrine of signatures that were strengthening the tendons. But Dujong, we're in the tonify yang category. So we see this a lot in our yang tonics, like Yogwewan. It's also like by going to the tendons, it strengthens tendons and bones. It's really good for strengthening the low back. We see it in things like Duhuo Jisheng Tong to strengthen tendon and bone. And I guess the other thing I think about with Dujong is by modern research, it has some effect of lowering high blood pressure. So we see it in modern high blood pressure formulas like Tian Ma Go Tong Yin. So that's what I know off the top of my head about Dujong. Can I taste my blood pressure lowering? Blood pressure. I was going to say, it seemed kind of weird to me that a yang tonic would be used to lower high blood pressure.
So. Yeah. Well, I'll let you see what you feel. I'm going to drink a little bit more. I'll comment on that specific thing if you don't make a comment on it yourself after drinking it.
Yeah, because I do taste a little bit of sweetness, but I taste like a little bit of earthiness, mm-hmm. like almost like that we get with like a puar, and so it does feel like it's going downward. It's not that up in the head like the huang qi might give me a headache after a while. This is going a little bit more downward.
For some reason, mine's a little bit almost like sour, like there was a drop of lemon. I wonder if there was something at the bottom of my pot when I cooked it. Do you get a little sour?
Not super. I wouldn't say sour like vinegar, but I'm thinking about the difference between light roast coffee and dark roast coffee. They say light roast is a little bit more acidic and it has a little bit more of that sour flavor. It's kind of more like that. I wouldn't say it's like apple cider vinegar sour.
No, not apple cider vinegar sour, no.
But that kind of like light roast coffee.
That's definitely sour. What I'm getting. Like, I don't know if you ever have like a bottled tea. They often put citric acid in there as a preservative, but just like a tiny amount.
Oh, okay.
So it's just like that hint of sour in the back. So I guess that is that gathering, and it's heavy.
Do you feel it going to your liver or anything?
I don't feel anything in my liver, but I definitely feel a downward sensation. Like, compared to the other one, I suddenly don't want to talk at all. I don't know if you feel that at all, but you're already talking way quieter. Like, with Huangqi, yeah. You were sitting upright.
Yeah.
Your hands are in the air.
I was getting shouty.
Excited, at least. When we drank this with the herb tasting course that I took with Andrew and Julianne, like the whole class was just like, And it was just like, oh, it's not just me. It's not just the guy next to me.
Yeah.
So it's pretty profoundly does that. And I'm actually, since tasting that and experiencing it, I've thought about it for my patients with like Shen disturbance, so to speak. Like it kind of anchors that yang.
Yeah, and I guess I wouldn't have thought about that in terms of like a longgu muli or something like the traditional anchoring things we think of. I wouldn't have thought about that.
Mm-hmm.
Like even in terms of like a bark, you wouldn't think that for a bark even.
But rogue, for example, is used to kind of guide the fire back to the mingmun, and it is a bark, and it is kind of heavy.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
I'm sorry. I got this one makes me a little bit sleepy. And for some reason right away, and I don't know how much of it is Pavlovian at this point.
Yeah, but I was going to say, historically, I feel like I haven't really, like, I've been jealous of people who are really sensitive to these things. Like, sometimes when I would give samples in class, I'd be like, okay, let's cook some Xiaoyao-san. And I'd get, like, one student who just took a sip and she's like, I feel high right now. What's in this stuff? I feel high. It's like, I've never felt that way with herbs. And I'm kind of jealous that you feel immediate reactions. But
I think it's actually a great learning tool probably for first-year students who don't haven't opened the books yet. I think it's really fantastic for trying to figure out what an herb you don't know yet does. And that actually, that's one of the things I started talking about before I got distracted, was that during COVID, I was working out of a clinic that had a bunch of Western herbs in stock there. And I didn't really have access to Chinese herbs, and I would often have patients come in, and I could use these herbs if I wanted to. So I'd already known about this tasting method, and I knew that herbs are categorized, at least in Chinese medicine originally, by flavor and nature. So I started sort of playing around with these Western herbs, tasting them, and being like, this has this flavor, what are the traditional indications and functions? And so I started kind of just a little bit for a couple of weeks or a few months before I ended up leaving New York, playing around with this idea of using Western herbs, tasting them, and trying to understand them from a Chinese medicine perspective. Now I kind of jokingly say that I think I'm going to work on developing the skill more, but like in an apocalyptic world, or if you know a certain country attacks another country and we don't have access to all of our Chinese herbs anymore, how am I going to be able to use the Western herbs? Like, do I have to learn a whole new theory? I think no, so long as I taste them, then look at how not the ancients, but how people have traditionally used them, and try to understand like, oh, okay, this herb is great for muscle cramps because XYZ flavor. So in muscle cramps that I think are due to XYZ condition, I'm going to prescribe this versus, you know, another herb that might have a similar function theoretically. So I think that's going to, if we can learn to understand herbs by tasting them, we can be much more flexible, and we can just like, you know, so long as we know it's not poisonous, we can just chew on something kind of intuitively then, or not intuitively, but based on this knowledge, use it medicinally. It's exciting to me. I don't know. Maybe it sounds silly to you.
I guess with that, I was thinking of other things like, well, like one, if we don't have access to herbs in China, or some people talk about to what extent have the herbs changed, have the environment changed? Can we rely on these books from 2000 years ago when the soil and the environment is different? And do we just have to rely on Shendong's stomach from window in a stomach from all those years ago? Or do we have a way to update this? And then I think it gets into even things like if we want to talk about the properties of coffee, like can we empirically deduce what effect that is having on the body, sort of thing?
I think that's actually a really great point. And I think that's one of the big reasons that my teachers put such an emphasis on this, Andrew and Julianne, because when they lived in China for, I can't remember how long they lived there together. Andrew lived there from like 88 to 2014 or something like this. So they had access to like really high grade herbs and or all sorts of herbs for that matter that were relatively fresh. And so they were used to a certain thing. And then when they moved to Asheville, you know, the things that they were getting were not consistently great. I mean, and they only order organic herbs. So they make sure that whatever they get is clean as clean can be. And they would prescribe it. But still, they were seeing some things aren't as great as they can be. And they started growing their own herbs. So they actually have their own herbal farm. They have like a terraced farm of different herbs that they've been growing. And, you know, there's only so many things you can grow for yourself, but it's very interesting because it's not that same, it's not growing in that traditional growing environment. So how do we figure out what to do with this chrysanthemum that grows in Asheville in North Carolina? You taste it, you see what it does. And, you know, I remember one year I was visiting them and shadowing them in clinic, and like we would taste some chrysanthemum that they just grew, and it was so bitter. It was really cold. And I was very surprised because chrysanthemum is like this, you don't think of it as a heavy hitter. But this specific chrysanthemum, oh, you can use this to treat some real nasty shit. But maybe not the chrysanthemum you buy at the Chinese pharmacy, because if you taste that, that's nice and pleasant and a little bit sweet and a little bit cold. But you can, like, this wasn't just cold and bitter, like not just bitter flavor, but like it made you cold. So it's, I think you're absolutely right. If we don't taste what we have, we don't know what it does. Another great example is dangui. Like dangui varies so much in flavor, and it can be anywhere from bitter to acrid to sweet. And if you don't know what you're drinking or you don't know what you're prescribing, you don't know what the patient's going to get as far as function goes. And if we look at the books, like sometimes there'll be so many different flavors listed. And so if we look at the Materia Medica, like the Bensky, they just list pretty much all of the flavors that have been recorded. But if we look at specific doctors or like other materia medica throughout time, one materia medica might list Renchen, for example, famously is currently is listed as a hot herb or a warm herb. But in the Shang Hanlun, it was used as a cold herb. But I think that's one of the benefits of tasting it, so you can understand what you are using. So maybe this is not the thing that Zhang Zhongjing was prescribing. This is a different thing, or it's a similar thing. And we need to modify it accordingly, or maybe it's now safer to use for a longer period of time or something like that. So I did want to just mention these teachers again. As I mentioned, I primarily study herbs with Andrew and Julianne Nugent-Head, and I think they're really great resources for people. I mean, they're fantastic herbalists, and they treat like the most difficult types of cases. People come to them after having been failed by herbalists all around the world or the country. Like, people will sometimes move to Asheville to live there and get treated by them for a prolonged period of time. But luckily, they also teach. And they have an online teaching platform and an in-person teaching, in-person teaching, as well as an ability to shadow them in their clinic. So the things I wanted to really share that are related to the herb tasting, there's four things. First, it's this free course that Julianne offers. Here are four articles that she has written that really go into whatever we've been talking about in way more detail and way more eloquently with better quotes. And she has her videos uploaded here of her tasting the single herbs, discussing what they've been said to do traditionally in various materia medica and what how she uses them in the clinic, etc. So I think there's a good 30, 40 herbs here. And it's a really great way to get introduced to this as a way of interacting with herbal medicine. And then Andrew is doing an in-person course this coming year called The Practical Herbalist. And there are no prerequisites, but it's recommended that you have some familiarity with this material already, because in that course, we're going to be experiencing herbs. We're going to, like, for example, compare what is 5 grams of Huangdian versus 15 versus 60 versus 150. How much you use the herb in a formula, how much you modify a classic formula, when do you need to substitute Baishao for Dangui in Guizhetang? And things like this, kind of really going deep into understanding the nuances between small and medium and large doses, tasting them and experiencing them and modifying herbs. I think it's going to be really cool. We just finished a year-long course with Julianne where she did that as an introductory course where we tasted, 100 different herbs over the course of the year in class together, discussing case studies and stuff like this. It was fantastic. And I'm really looking forward to Andrew's, follow up on that. So if your listeners are all interested, there'll be a link apparently.
And for those other ones, is this for students, practitioners? Should people know something about herbs, or can they just,
so
should they be practicing?
I would recommend, so Julianne's free content is you should be doing something with medicine. It's not a great place for someone who knows zero, like a first year student. But once you've already like gotten a little bit of basics, you can be a first year student. I think it's a really great place to start learning herbs, because it starts based on the source material, like the way it was, created, versus TCM, which where we're starting all the way at the front and working our way back. This starts at the back and works your way front. So you can understand all of the different layers of opinions and knowledge and commentary as you come across them. Plus, it'll be like what we talked about, where you can experience it without knowing what it's supposed to do, and then you can feel genuinely what it does. I think that's a really cool approach, and I wish I had access to that, but better now than never. Then her long-form class online is a great continuation from her free stuff, and I don't think you need any background herbal knowledge, because she kind of takes you by the hand.
You want to talk about external applications or topicals?
Sure. So let me switch from Duzhong to beer. I picked this up today. It's Christmas time, so I wanted something dark. Today's actually first day of Hanukkah, but cheers. Oh, this porter hits nice after all that herby stuff.
So what about topical herbs? Can we do the same thing topically and externally taste our herbs, or how do we know the functions there?
Well, I don't know if we can just put an herb on our skin and necessarily know right away what it does. However, there are certain herbs you put on your skin you feel right away, like bohe nao or zhang nao, bing pian. They're going to have an effect right away. Hua jiao. I know you were earlier, you were commenting on eCherb. Do you want to?
No, well, I got comments recently that sometimes I mention things in Chinese and people can't understand what I'm saying. They're like, oh, can you put subtitles on there? Because you say those Chinese names real fast. I don't actually know what you're talking about. But,
gotcha.
But we're talking about like menthol and camphor and stuff like that. Yeah, when you put that stuff on your skin, you feel the tingle right away.
Yeah, you feel the tingle. I mean, cinnamon, it'll give a bit of a burn. I don't know if... I give this example a lot, and nobody knows what I'm talking about. So hopefully someone out there listening. Has anyone ever licked a big red wrapper and stuck it on their forehead as a kid? Or was this only people in my neighborhood in Brooklyn?
I was going to say, I don't think I've ever done that.
All right. Well, I'm a weirdo. Anyway, it burns. A cinnamon wood.
Yeah. No. I remember somebody saying that when we were talking about Posamon, which I think has a lot of cinnamon mm-hmm. in it. He said his sisters would get it on their hands and then try to like stab him in the eyes with it and try to make his eyes burn. I think that's the closest I've got.
No, I wouldn't do this. It was like, you know, it's like eating a warhead candy. It's like, how much suffering can you inflict on yourself with candy?
Oh, oh okay.
Anyway.
So, but forehead application of cinnamon, you can feel that.
You can absolutely feel that it burns. So I think to an extent, we can definitely feel certain herbs on the skin, and those are the ones that are probably the most frequently used. However, when we taste the herb, we can still extrapolate its function. So when we use a topical herb, we're still using it, considering that if we're using Dongguai topically, that it's going to move the blood. So when we taste it and it tastes like it's going to move the blood, we can consider that it might work that way topically. So I haven't formed a concrete opinion as to when can an herb be used topically. Theoretically, you know, any blood-moving herb should be able to be used topically, but through empirical evidence, through experience, through the records we have and through formula we've seen, we see that some are better than others. So we use the ones that are better than others just because that's what tradition tells us. And, you know, sometimes it's better not to mess with things, especially if they work well. If we were having trouble, then we can experiment more. So the most important thing, though, topical should work. If they don't work, if you think maybe they kind of work, then they probably don't work.
And I guess one of the things I have trouble with is how do we necessarily differentiate them? Because I feel like when I was in school, we had this big tray of – we had Posamon, white flower oil, Ditdejiao, Zhenggu Shui, woodlock oil. And nobody could ever quite explain what the difference was. Sometimes I go look up formulas for Ditdejiao and it's like there might be some recipe with like 100 different ingredients in it. It's like they just threw the whole kitchen sink in there. Is there a way to differentiate these in terms of what they do? How deeply do they penetrate? Like, how do we navigate that?
So, I mean, I can really only speak from my experience. And even though I make topicals, I make dragon blood balm, some variations of it. I can't say that I'm by any means like a master expert on all of the topicals. But I think we do have to look at the nature and flavor of the thing that we're using. So the easiest one is to differentiate as a hot formula or a cold formula. And white flower oil is cold. And it literally, I think, only has menthol and maybe one or two other ingredients in it. So it's cold as cold can be. Whereas, I don't know if you've ever seen Taoist oil.
No, I haven't.
It's really hot. Like literally you took two or three drops of it and that's the whole thing, like for a whole knee. It's really, really hot and it burns and it feels like peppers on your skin. So, I mean, it's really easy when it's like that to differentiate that. So you use the hot one for cold conditions and the cold one for hot conditions. But your question is really good because I have been struggling with that as I've been working on Dragon Blood Balm and trying to really fine tune it. And as I was coming up with the original formula and how I use it in the clinic and how do I sell it to my patients and then feel good about it and being like, okay, this is the thing that's appropriate for this condition. We have to look at what do most of the herbs do typically? So typically, most of the herbs in these formulas move. They move qi, they move blood. And that's why there's so much overlap. Because when you move qi and blood, healing happens. You don't need to only use one type of herb versus another type of herb. I think, you know, when you throw a kitchen sink in alcohol and soak it, it's not necessarily going to be better than another thing. I think that typically comes from when people don't really understand the individual herbs and they just want to cover all their bases, and that's probably fine. A lot of the Dita formulas aren't coming from like Zhang Zhongjing sitting with a long beard and being like, I want five herbs to create this kind of movement with a little bit of this and a little bit of that and then a pivot in the middle. No, it's martial artists who've been like punching things and they're like, my hands hurt. I need something to stick them in.
Yeah, it's like what do we got in the backyard right now that we can throw in there?
It's like we got some cinnamon, some scorpions under a rock, and some iron filings. Let's throw it all in some alcohol and soak it. Probably shouldn't drink it. I'm being a little facetious, but that's my kind of understanding of when a formula has so many ingredients, especially topically, because it's hard to know exactly what's going to get absorbed. But a lot of them are really important, though, because when we see the topicals with all the bugs in them, those are really important when there's like really bad bone bruises, when there's like nerve damage, when things really need to heal, not for like a sprain or a strain, some kind of typical overuse injury, but those are going to be great.
But like deep in there?
Deep in there and severe. So actually, the Nugent heads were telling us a case study about this woman who had really severe scleroderma. And I'm not going to go into the history of it, but part of the treatment was that they had their teacher actually had her take baths of topical herbs, and there were like, you know, bugs in there, like scorpions and these really things that get things moving. And scleroderma is this condition where the skin is like literally hardening and becoming like immobile and it can't move. So in those cases, you really need the herbs that are going to be able to penetrate deep and create lots of movements. So, you know, I'm not going to go, it's not my case study to share, but the patient did get a lot better. And she was kind of forsaken by doctors saying that nothing can be happening. Anyway, so those are like, when we see those kinds of herbs in a formula, we can think, okay, this is intended for severe conditions, for bone breaks, not for like, I overworked out and I overstretched something. Posamon is interesting because I think it's a warming formula, but there's so much menthol in it, it kind of distracts you. So, but the menthol is interesting because I don't think it penetrates super deep. It kind of makes the skin really cold, but if the other herbs are able to get in and warm the tissues, it's cooling on the surface to kind of numb things and then creating warmth below. And I think that's why everything has menthol, and that's why it can get a little bit confusing. And I'm not an expert on evil bone water or jungu shui, but if we look at those herbs, a lot of them really focus on blood and damp transformation. And there are fewer herbs in higher doses, so they're more pinpoint. So like baijiu is very, very aromatic. I mean, if you drink it, it's like super light and misty, and it just goes up to the nose. But we can imagine if you apply that, it's going to do something similar. So those oils are going to get in there and create movement up and out. So it's going to open up so that everything else can go in, and the menthol and the camphor also kind of open things and cool and stop pain right away, but they also help other things to penetrate. I don't know if you've seen, I think it's called black ghost oil. It has turpentine, and turpentine helps to guide herbs quite deeply because turpentine penetrates very deeply. I was actually working on a dragon blood balm variant with turpentine, but couldn't find sourcing that's affordable enough where I could produce it and not charge like crazy amounts of money. And people get weird about that. They hear turpentine, like, oh, I don't want to put paint thinner on me.
Yeah.
But natural turpentine is really good. If we call it pine oil, it sounds much less innocuous. But I think that's an important way to just differentiate, is look at the flavors and the temperatures of the herbs in the formulas, and that'll tell you what they do. And if they're really similar, that's because, you know, cinnamon is not the only warm herb. Ginger is not the only warm herb. Like the writers of those formulas want to warm and create movement. They don't want to use scorpions. They don't want to use futsu. They want to warm and create movement. And so they just find herbs that do that. So a lot of like the Dita formulas and the bone break formulas, they'll find the hottest, most moving herbs and they'll use them. So like chuanwu or caowu, and these are all very like parts of futsu for the people who don't know the specific herbs.
Yeah, yeah, the different aconite plants. Yeah,
and that's why they'll use them. Yeah. Well, that's why, for example, evil bone water doesn't have those, because evil bone water is fantastic to just keep in your pocket for anything because it doesn't have any of those toxic herbs. It creates movement using light acrid herbs, and it creates movement using blood-moving herbs like sanchi. So it's great for a variety of things. Maybe it's not the best thing for like a severe broken bone for like that day one when you need something really like that. But it's like really great for most, like 80 to 90% of things. And it's going to do something good for that bone, for that broken bone, but maybe not something, it doesn't have that, those creepy crawlies and those poisonous herbs.
Yeah, not as good as the scorpions and centipedes that will crawl in there and knit your bones back together. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the important thing to think about there. So, for example, the product I made, Dragon Blood Balm. Go on.
Yeah, I was going to say the product you make and Mark makes, that I guess that would be an example of how do we differentiate those two? If I, because you sometimes even sell them together. So if I have both of those on my shelf or both of those that I can sell to a patient, when would I use Evil Bone Water and when would I use Dragon Blood Balm?
So that's a really good question, and I think these two products, almost by accident, have a really great synergy. So I'll first start by saying they don't have almost any overlapping ingredients other than the menthol and the Biger. So that's one thing. So they're kind of complementary in that way, that they fill in areas that the other one doesn't do. So I've already talked a little bit about Evil Bone Water, but I'll just say briefly that it's really great at stopping pain. It stops pain right away because of a lot of those kind of the camphor, the menthol, the sanchi that work on the surface and move blood. And they also gets in there, it helps to transform damp, and it penetrates quite deeply. So it does help with bone bruises, and it's great for fractures. It's just, you know, there are sometimes better things, but if you're only going to have one thing, it's a fantastic one to use. Dragon Blood Balm was created to work more on the superficial aspects of things. And I originally created it for rock climbers. Well, I originally created it for myself because I was, I think, still in acupuncture school, or just finished acupuncture school, starting herbal medicine school, because I split it up because I did acupuncture and massage first, and then I went back to do herbs. And I had enough herbal knowledge to be able to come up with this formula, and I started rock climbing. And you know, the first time I went rock climbing, I was in Korea at the time. After I'd finished acupuncture school, I went to Korea for a month to do stuff. And the first time I rock climbed, I couldn't hold chopsticks for like a week. So I was like eating with my left hand, using a spoon. It was the only thing I could use.
I guess, was that like was the surface ripped up, or was it just like a grip strength thing? Because I feel like I've had both of those happen.
So both. Literally, I had no skin on three of my fingers here and here. I guess, you know, I was 24 and really eager and super excited, and I was having too much fun and had no skill. So, yeah, I couldn't hold chopsticks. My skin was destroyed, but I also had a lot of what's called pump. So essentially all of these muscles were just full of blood, and like I could not close my hand more than like that. So I was walking around like with a T-Rex hand here, and like this one's kind of also beat up, and like eating with a spoon like this. And so that experience made me sort of think like, okay, I really love that. That was so fun, but I obviously cannot hold a tiny needle I'm going to or touch anybody with this rough skin. So I started working on a formula, and at first I just was using, Eagle Claw Liniment that I found in Tom Bizio's book, Tooth from the Tiger's Mouth, which is fantastic, really great book.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I remember the day that I was like trying to put it together, it had like things like crab shells in it, and I didn't realize it was crab shells. So I was going to all of the pharmacies and being like, do you have, forget the name of it now, but like I was like, do you have this herb? And they're like, no, we don't carry that. and then finally someone's like, that's a crab shell, we don't carry that. I was like, oh. So I went to the fish market, also in Chinatown, bought a bunch of crabs, cooked them, ate them, took the shells, cleaned them so they wouldn't smell too fishy, roasted them, and then I made this. I actually still have this Eagle Claw Liniment that I made because it was just really stinky. I didn't end up using too much of it.
Oh, yeah.
But it was quite effective. So I was rubbing this in my hands and then putting Shunko cream on top. I don't know if you're familiar with Shunko cream, also known as purple cloud ointment.
Yeah, I was going to say the Chinese is Zuyungao. Purple cloud ointment. But that's in Japanese style, they use it as their burn cream when they do moxa.
Yeah,
so yeah, I think most people should be familiar with that. Even if they haven't used it, you've probably seen it in the clinic, even if you don't know it.
Yeah, it's a really great like heal most skin balm. It's Dangui, Zicao. Sometimes it's just Dangui and Zicao. maybe huangqi.
Yeah, I was going to say, usually I see it's just that, and then maybe like some sesame oil or something.
Yeah, sesame oil and beeswax.
I guess I've never known, is the sesame oil, does that have a medicinal property, or it's just what they had on hand for a medium?
I think sesame oil has a medicinal property. The reason I stopped using sesame oil in Dragon Blood Bomb, which we did originally use, actually, is because it has a very strong smell. And like already the herbs have a strong smell, so I was trying to find things that maybe... can, like, for example, jojoba has a lot of similar properties. It's less blood nourishing, but it's still pretty good. But it doesn't have, it's pretty neutral.
Yeah, I was going to say some of the burn creams, like the Qinghongwan, it's something when you put that on, it's like you definitely smell like sesame mm-hmm. for the rest of the day.
But it helps to nourish the blood and moisten the skin. It's very good for helping skin to heal. So I would kind of be using these two formulas. And then I decided, well, let me see if I can make my own thing. Because, I mean, frankly, the eagle claw liniment was a little bit stinky, and it also had a lot of toxic herbs. And the thing is, with rock climbing, your skin is constantly open, and I didn't want to keep putting it in there. So I got to work to try to put together a formula that was safe to use on open cuts, but also good for the skin. And, you know, the first iteration looked something like ziyingao with frankincense, myrrh, dragon blood. So, and all of those herbs, the reason I chose them is because they move blood, move qi, stop pain, and generate flesh.
Yeah.
And are great for non-healing sores. So, like, that's the key of that. It's like ziyingao plus these three herbs. It's great for any kind of flesh that's not healing. And I played around with adding different herbs to make it penetrate not just on the skin, because obviously, like, my hands are hurting, not just the skin hurts.
Yeah, at a muscular level.
Yeah, the muscular or tendon level. Yeah. The other injury that I was getting was I was starting to get pulley injuries, which is essentially, you can see how this bunch is right here. A pulley is a tendon sheath that goes across these tendons here, and it kind of gets ripped because, you know, you're putting way too much weight on your fingertips.
Yeah.
So anyway, I just kept playing around with the formula to make it penetrate deep enough, but using herbs that are safe for open cuts. And essentially, I came up with Dragon Blood Bomb this way because it was something I needed. And actually, I was sitting with my friend after a climbing session, and I was like, hey, you know, try this. And he's like, oh, I like this. My girlfriend liked it. We were sitting having ramen in a bar on the Upper East Side in Manhattan, and he was like, let's make this a business. I was like, this is good. This is going to help some people. And he always wanted to have his own business, and he was excited because, and I don't do marketing, I don't do graphic design, and we're like, all right, let's do this. So, like, we started brainstorming, and that was 5 years ago already somehow. So anyway, how is it different than Evil Bone Water? So, Dragon Blood Bomb generates flesh. It's an important thing to remember. It also moves blood and stops pain, and is great for that kind of thing. But it, like, the big difference there is that it generates flesh, and that's a big emphasis, while moving blood and stopping pain. I use it frequently as a standalone topical herb for painful conditions, and we have plenty of people who use it for joint pain, ankle pain. I have people, like, I have a woman who's a farrier, which is a person who makes horseshoes. Like, she sent us a review saying that, you know, my horse keeps kicking me, and the Dragon Blood Bomb is the only thing that keeps me going. And we're like, oh, you know, that feels really good to hear. So, like, getting feedback like that made us, like, want to keep going with the company. And when I started talking to Mark and using his product, which is an alcohol base, so it actually penetrates deeper than a beeswax based, I was talking to him and I realized they really work well together, because you apply an alcohol based topical, like a Dita Zhao or a Zheng Gu Shui or Evil Bone Water, and then you put that beeswax on top. It sort of seals it in, so it's not evaporating and drying off.
Oh, okay.
It now has a water phobic, hydrophobic, like, covering on it. So now it's not going to go up; it's only going to go down. And then it's going to, as it goes in, it's going to bring in the Dragon Blood Bomb itself. So they have this, like, interplay of a yin and yang thing going. And plus, if you're combining them on areas that are beat up and cut, I find that Zheng Gu Shui, or I mean, actually not Zheng Gu Shui, but Evil Bone Water, is safe to use on all sorts of open cuts, even though I don't know if it's officially is or not, but I use it on everything.
I was going to say, I've used it to stop bleeding. Like, there's so much Sanchi in it, I've actually used it to stop bleeding when I didn't have, like, a
Styptic, like, or Yunnan Bio.
Yeah.
And so, but it doesn't, it'll speed up the blood flow and stuff like this, and because it's the alcohol based, it kills infections, and there's some cold herbs in there too, so it'll kill off bacteria. But the dragon blood balm helps to really get things to knit together. So if you put it in a cut and put both, it knits it together. The dragon blood balm works great on its own, but together they work so well. So on our website on Dragon Blood Balm, we're one of the places you can actually buy Evil Bone Water one at a time, not wholesale. We oftentimes sell it packed together with Dragon Blood Balm, and that's how I use it in my clinic. So in my clinic, I typically don't use either one of them alone anymore. The only time I'll use the Dragon Blood Balm alone only is if I'm doing massage, and it's really good for that. It's way better than an alcohol-based liniment. Or if I just want to spray something on and I don't want to touch it, then I'll use only the Evil Bone Water. But typically I'm using both at the same time because they work so well together. And most of my patients have both in their purse or bag at all times.
Okay. Oh, so even from a patient perspective, you're using
that's
both.
How I prescribe it. I tell them, do this and this.
Okay. Oh, awesome.
And then I tell them, if you only want to use one, this is when you use this one, this is when you use this one. And sometimes the Dragon Blood Balm is great because we sell it in a tiny thing like this, and you only use a little bit at a time. It's great to put in your pocket or in your purse or anything like this. Whereas Evil Bone Water, it's a bit bigger like this, but it's still flight safe. So it's 3.4 ounces explicitly labeled. So you can put it in your carry-on and no one's going to bother you.
Yeah, because I was trying to think of what are some other regenerating flesh things I would use it for other than rock climbing. Because initially I was thinking I would use it after lifting weights. It's kind of the same thing when you're deadlifting. You're still, it's the same thing where you're using a lot of chalk on your hands. You got instead of the rough surface of the climbing wall, you got the knurling on there, and it tears up your hands in the same way.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great use. We had a lot of nurses using it from washing hands too much. I definitely use it. I mean, just when I'm applying it to patients, I'll just make sure if I have a dry patch, I'm like, oh, let me just apply a little bit on myself as I massage it in.
I was going to say that was an interesting thing that I guess the modern version would be people washing their hands all the time. I remember my Chinese teacher telling a story about they went on a field trip to plant rice, and it was when they had their hands in the cold water planting rice, then they got the same chapped thing. But I guess, yeah, that would be the modern version is people have to wash their hands all the time. They get so dry that they start to crack, and so then you'd want to regenerate flesh.
Yeah. I mean, another place, I'll just give you a couple of more examples. I have a diabetic patient with non-healing sores. She uses that. It helps. I actually use both in combination. But literally, I had a patient. It wasn't the thing that saved her legs, but it was part of the complex of things. And, she came to me with sores in her feet that were down to the bone, and they wanted to amputate, and she didn't want to amputate. And I was like, listen, I will treat you if you're getting monitored by your doctor weekly. And so she was having a nurse come to her twice a week because I didn't want to miss sepsis. But if we had somebody paying attention, worst case scenario, they cut off her leg. Best case scenario, they don't cut off her leg. So we were able to get the sores to heal using acupuncture, topical herbs, internal herbs. But Dragon Blood Balm, Evil Bone Water were a big part of that to get that flesh to regenerate. And she still has her legs. I didn't fix her diabetes. Her kidneys aren't better necessarily all the way. But, I think that's pretty cool. So that's one thing.
Yeah, and I think that's an example we use in herb class a lot when we talk about those herbs that regenerate flesh, like the Ruxiang Moyao, but also the Huang Qi and the Dong Wei have some action of regenerating flesh. And I feel like that's
why they're in there.
Yeah, that might be the examples that we use, when you say non-healing sores. I think diabetic sores or bed sores from sitting in one place. So that just kind of connected two dots in my brain when you said that just now.
Yeah. Speaking of bed sores, I don't see bed sores so much in my clinic, but I do unfortunately see older, overweight people with sores in between their flaps of fat.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
It's really great in there. It's red and sore. I'll give it to them. Next week they come back and it's all healed. My grandma, she gets really cracked fingertips just from in the wintertime. She gets sort of a Raynaud's kind of thing. She puts a little bit in there and it knits in 2 days. And I actually had a patient the other day. So she had colon cancer. And so they completely removed the large intestine. I'll get to the skin, but we know that the large intestine is responsible for the skin.
Yeah.
From a Western perspective, that's where water actually gets absorbed, or the rest of the water gets absorbed before it leaves the body. So in her case, because she literally does not have a large intestine, they did this thing is called a J pouch. We won't go into too much detail, but it's essentially they extend the small intestine, kind of loop it around and attach it to the exit hole. Her skin's really dry and cracking, no matter how much water she drinks. But since I gave her Dragon Blood Bomb, it's like night and day. I mean, her skin's still dry, but there's like no cracks anywhere, and it's in so much better shape. She told me she came back. She was seeing me like a couple times that week. I applied it in the office, and she came back the next day because she had another visit. And she's like, "My hands are so much better. I need that stuff."
Oh, awesome! Because I guess normally when I think of topical things, I guess I'd naturally think of more like tendinomuscular arthritis, B syndrome. Mm-hmm. Is that
for sure?
Is that not in the scope, or is that still something?
No, that isn't. That is in the scope for sure.
Because I feel like we're still invigorating a lot of blood, like
exactly,
that Ruxiang,
exactly.
Mo Yao, Shui Jie. That's not just regenerating flesh; it's also invigorating blood.
That's why I thought it's like the most amazing thing to use topically, because you can use it, like, it doesn't matter, the skin's broken, the tendon's broken, you know, I'll use it for these pulley injuries, people use it on their tennis elbow, I have folks you know, massaging it into their stiff necks, all sorts of things. Yeah, you just asked about the regenerate flesh option.
Oh yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
That's why I mentioned it. I also made essentially I took the ingredients that I use for Dragon Blood Bomb, and after I'd soaked them in oil, I also soaked them in alcohol. This was just like a little experiment. And I ended up hurting a joint, like a nerve really badly. So then I'm like, oh, let me just try this. And I tried all of the different topicals I had, but until I did that alcohol extract of the same formula, that pain didn't go away. And that one, like once I applied it, it went away in like a day and a half. The other thing is I put really high doses of everything. So like, you know, typically if you see like a jar with oil and stuff in it, there'll be like some herbs at the bottom and it's mostly oil. Hey, I'll actually show you.
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like I see a lot of things where like it's a lot of menthol and then just a little bit of other herbs.
Yeah, you see, I mean, it's hard to see because it's really dark, but you can see that the herbs come up over the top all across.
Yeah.
So this is like 3 liters of oil, and we use like a kilogram of herbs for that approximately. So that's like, we kind of stuff it all in there. And we also, like, we pre-soak it like this. So this is, we're pre-soaking in the jojoba. Then we cook it. And then we take the herbs from there and we throw it in the hemp oil. And we let that soak forever, essentially, until we use up the hemp oil. The reason being is that the jojoba oil is pretty stable in heat. So when we cook it, it doesn't get damaged. But the hemp oil is, it's much more heat sensitive, so we don't want to break it down. But hemp oil has a lot of omega-3s and omega-6s, and from, I don't know what they do from a Chinese medicine perspective, but they're great for your skin.
Yeah.
And it also, you know, it has some nice functions other than that. So we let them soak there, cook there, and soak there. So we try to get as much out of it as possible, and we also agitate regularly. So I just gave away the secret, guys. So, but it's not really a secret formula. We put the ingredients everywhere.
Yeah. Is the extraction different in oil versus alcohol? Because I feel like maybe that's a thing where I guess I usually see like Dongui and Zicao. It's like you would soak in oil or you would toast in oil. Whereas like Ruxiang Moyao, I feel like I usually see them like dissolved in alcohol. Is there an extraction? When some are better boiled in water, is there an extraction difference there?
Absolutely. So everyone I talked to couldn't give me a clear answer. So essentially how I chose the herbs that I did include, I just looked at what the traditional herbs used, the ones that appeared most frequently in balms, like topical, like in a gao. I made sure to include that. But we also double up, and a lot of the herbs we include, we also use an essential oil as well.
Okay.
So not only are we putting super high doses of raw herbs, we're also putting a lot of essential oils. So, you know, that same Ruxiang, that same Moyao, that Dangui, that Baijiu, the like everything, like we try to double up. So we're getting as much as possible in there. And that's why actually like I use a tiny amount and it does a lot. It's super concentrated stuff. The only bad thing about it is that it stains clothing.
Oh, okay. It does have a very beautiful red color, mm-hmm. I have to say.
It's not beautiful if it goes on a white shirt that should be white.
Is there anything like ground up into a powder and just mix with the oil? Because I'm thinking about like Qingdai San, Qingdai Gao, like that. I think that's what they usually do with some of those. They just grind it up into a powder and then mix it. And I guess maybe the powder has some sort of reaction.
So in our specific product, not on purpose, but because we do grind our herbs and we use like, what do you call it? We use like a Michelin bag. Some powder does come out. So it ends up being suspended in there, but that's not by design. That's just by like, because it happens that way. But like a really great example, that brings me to my, like my first experience, my real first experience with topical herbs where it was successful is San Juan Gao. Mm-hmm. So I think this one's useful. Like I know you have a lot of first year students. If you want to go through the ingredients.
Yeah.
Those are.
Yeah.
Let's do that thing where you turn to the side and you list everything.
Herbal ice. Like I have to stop and think about it because especially when it's getting this late and I've had this many herbs. That's one we usually call herbal ice. Mm-hmm. And the three huangs are a little bit weird because the first huang is Da Huang and the other two huangs, I can never remember which of the three huangs it is.
Huang Bai for sure.
Yeah, Huang Bai. And then I think it's not Huang Lian. So I think it might be Huang Qin.
So yeah, Huang Qin. And sometimes people put like Pu Gong Ying or something else.
Yeah, I was going to say, sometimes people add in other things and either even other Huangs.
But like you choose Da Huang and two other Huangs.
Jurtze, yeah, yeah.
Jurtze, that's the one that's used there frequently. But the main thing is Huang, Da Huang, Huang Bai, and one other Huang. And essentially you grind it up into a powder, fine powder, boil it in melted oil for a little bit and put in beeswax or petroleum jelly and it's good to go. It's ready to go. Or sometimes people will take those powder herbs and just put it in a raw egg and like make it a paste out of that and then apply that. And so the story is I was living in an apartment with like four other guys and we were up in Harlem and this was like my first year of acupuncture school and I was also doing martial arts. So I was really excited about all these topical things. So I at the time I had the least money because I was in school and I lived in the living room. So I just had like paper screens around my bed. So I'm sleeping and my friend, actually Roman, who we make Dragon Blood Bomb with, he kind of rushes in and he's like, Boris, are you sleeping? I'm like, not anymore. He's like, my friend just got hit by a scooter. Can you fix her? You're a doctor, right? I'm like, dude, I'm a first year acupuncture student, but let me look. So she had this like big bruise on her hip and literally that was the only thing I had. So I was like, well, she doesn't look like she's dying. Let's put this stuff on her and then see how she does tomorrow. So I made a pulse. I had the pre-prepared. I'd put it on some gauze, put it on there, taped it, and I was like, all right, good night. I went back to sleep. Next day, she's walking without a limp. There's like, the bruise is tiny, and like, there's almost no pain, and I was just like, wow, this topical stuff works, because it was like a really nasty looking thing, and I was really surprised at the efficacy, and I was like, okay, cool. And so that's barely extracted. That's a quick boil, and that's just the powder applied to the skin.
Yeah, I was going to say, sometimes I've seen people that they just take the powder, mix it with Vaseline, and they say spread it on like cream cheese, and it works. And that one's definitely cold. All those herbs are cold. So I think that one we can definitely say is that the Da Huang is very good at invigorating blood, but all those herbs are cold. So it's definitely for like heat, swelling, heat conditions, acute conditions.
And that's the good thing to think about Da Huang. Actually, if we taste Da Huang compared to Huang Bai, Huang Lian, it has a much more like active flavor. It's not just like cold bitter. Poof. It has like a spiciness to it. It almost reminds me of mustard. So like we can taste that movement in the flavor if we were to taste it. It's actually a nice tasting herb compared to all the other Huangs. So like when you apply it, it creates movement. So it's not just the same thing as putting ice. It's much better because there's this invigoration of the blood. So it doesn't cause the long-term stasis issues. So like if we just were to put ice, it just causes vasoconstriction. So nothing good can get in or out and nothing bad can get in or out. So it won't swell, but the body can't heal it.
But that one's not going to have that regenerate flesh stuff.
No.
That's just going to be all about like clearing the heat and getting rid of the swelling.
But you were mentioning that the Qingdai, so that was, I think.
Oh, yeah. That's another example of a powder.
But frankincense, myrrh, and dragon blood, they're really great just as a powder applied into a wound. And you just leave them in as a matrix, and so the skin would close over it, sort of. But kind of like Yunnan Baiyao or Sanqi. But we don't use it that way because I'm trying to sell it for a more mass market. And it's kind of weird to tell non-TCM folks like, oh, put this powder in your open cut.
Yeah. And oh, it's totally fine. Your skin will grow over it. Like that sounds totally fine.
Yeah, it'll get pushed out.
I guess speaking of that, is this easy to explain to your patients, to your general public? Do you have to be like, oh, this is just Tiger Balm, but better? Or how do you explain it?
Well, that's actually a question we get a lot on our Facebook ads. Like, it's like, oh, this is just Tiger Balm. And we're like, well, no, Tiger Balm's great, but Tiger Balm warms things and stops pain. But it doesn't have any of those same blood-moving properties or regenerating flesh properties. It's quite different. For my patients, honestly, they don't really question it. I just tell them this is going to be good for this condition and use it X times a day. It's like most people don't need a lot of explanation. If I tell them like this is going to help your heel, like your Achilles tendon to heal, you can apply it there. If you have somewhere else that hurts, you can apply it. Don't eat it and don't get it on your clothes. with Evil Bone Water, I like put it anywhere it hurts. Don't use it more than 4 times a day in one spot because it can dry your skin. And then don't drink it. You'll probably have a stomach ache. So, I mean, but usually I'm prescribing it. So like when someone comes in, like I treat a lot of ballet dancers. So I just give them the instruction how I want them to use it. And then I don't worry about them misunderstanding it. And then if something else comes up, I'm like, oh, you remember that stuff I gave you? Like, yeah, you can put it there too. And they're like, oh, okay, awesome. And they get excited because they're like, oh, there's a new use for this thing.
And so if people do want to sell that, it's not just available individually. I mean, you can order it individually on your website, so people could always direct people there. But can you like sell it wholesale?
Yeah, we have we've recently simplified our wholesale options. People can buy – we have 3 sizes. We have a small – 4 sizes now, but one of them is not available wholesale. We have small, medium, and large. The small are like little sticks like lip balm, really easy to apply. Medium are like 1/2 ounce tins and large are the 1 ounce tins. And those typically, like, as I said, it's super concentrated. If we're using it only on the hands daily, the 1 ounce tin lasts like 1/2 year.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
And those are available for wholesale, but you could also order one online. And if you do order it online, make sure you use the link below because,
oh yeah, I'll put a coupon and everything mm-hmm. down there.
You get a little coupon and, yeah. So if you have any questions, specifically if this is something that any of the viewers want to incorporate in their clinic or just use for themselves, don't hesitate to email me, boris@dragonbloodbalm.com. I remember some of the early tests, like a big issue we had is that, you know, unfortunately or fortunately, Chinese herbs have flavors and natures and smell and they're exciting, but not everyone likes that. So some of the early versions of it, like we were testing and the feedback we were getting, like, oh, this smells like curry. The current versions don't. But like we were getting a lot of like mixed feedback like that. And somebody would be like, oh, this smells like curry. It's awesome. I want to use this all the time. And somebody else would be like, this is disgusting. I don't want to smell like that. We were giving out samples to like the rock climbing community to see if you get feedback. We sort of fine-tuned the formulas, figured out like, okay, what do we absolutely need to keep? What can we remove? Like one of the things that went by the wayside was chuanxiong. And it's a really good topical herb, but when we removed it, there wasn't much of a loss of function or any noticeable loss of function, but it has a really strong smell, especially the essential oil.
Yeah. Oh, I guess I haven't thought mm-hmm. about that with chuanxiong. I was going to say, though, mm-hmm. sometimes the main thing, I guess with some of those other topicals, like when they use sesame oil, I feel like that's all I smell is mm-hmm. the sesame oil.
And the original formula.
Qinghongwan.
Yeah, the original oil had like sesame oil and then chuanxiong and like all these other herbs. And the dangui has like a celery smell. And so like they're like, oh, it smells so savory.
Yeah.
And we found that actually adding in a good amount of, and originally we didn't have menthol. Because I didn't want it, I found it to be slightly irritating to open skin. And then it wasn't until we started sourcing from the same place that Mark Brinson Evil Bone Water sources from that we're like, oh, okay, this can be really good. And it's actually beneficial. And it also helps to like make it much more pleasant smelling.
Yeah, because I was going to say, is that another one that's like the difference between natural and synthetic?
So
I'm trying to think if that's menthol or if that was just turpentine that I'm still thinking about.
Well, turpentine for sure. So synthetic turpentine is kind of toxic and it's paint thinner. Natural turpentine, I would never drink it, but people have drunk it and reported it to be medicine. But topically, it's fine and it's really lovely and I love the smell. Camphor and menthol also synthetic can be a little bit toxic or questionable at least. The like natural stuff just acts a little bit differently. It dissolves a little bit differently. Unfortunately, I don't know enough to give you a better answer, but we stick to the natural stuff because, heck, why not?
Yeah, but like empirically, it seems to work.
Yeah, even though it's like quite a bit more expensive, it just seems to be better. It makes me feel better.
So I don't know. Anything else you want to add? I feel like I said, the wheels aren't turning very fast anymore.
No, I mean the doujong and the alcohol. I'm just curious, like what was your experience tasting herbs? Considering that you approached it before as like, that's the thing that my weird friend does.
I thought it was interesting because I guess it's something that I've never really sat and thought about it. Just usually it's like I take a formula and I drink the formula. It's like, ooh, either it's really cinnamony or it's really bitter or sometimes I more think of it as like I've been taking some formulas and I feel like I can distinguish. It's more like I'm distinguishing the ingredients. Like I'm taking this like, I've been taking some Wendantong. It's like, I can really taste the jershir in this one, stuff like that. I've never really thought about it as like, let me sit and think about, is this going to my head or is it sinking downward? So that was kind of interesting. And I think it's just, this might sound kind of weird, but I've never really been into tasting things before. I feel like I don't have a very discriminating palate, and I think it's just something I've done recently. Like I went through a phase where I got really into coffee, and I was like doing light roasts and medium roast and different brewing methods,
and like anaerobic and natural.
It's like when I changed the water from 180 degrees to brewing with 195 degrees, could I actually taste the difference? Could I taste those when they say, it tastes like cherry and chocolate? Could I with actually oak. Taste that? Yeah. And that was kind of the first time I thought about that. And that's why I was referencing, like when I said it tasted kind of sour, that's something I noticed when I tried comparing some of the really light roast versus the dark roast and some specific types of coffee. I started tasting like, this does taste a little bit sour, and I kind of like that. I wonder if I'm just a very wood person, but I really like that sourness. And so it's only recently that I've done that, but I've actually never done that with herbs. So it is kind of interesting to sit and think that way. Yeah.
So, like, I started off doing that with Chinese teas. So, like, I had some language and, like, paying attention to these things. And then, you know, when I did the herbs, I was like, obviously we should do this with herbs. But, yeah, like, it's really interesting once you start paying attention how much there is.
Yeah, and I guess I didn't think – it's like – I guess maybe I have done that with, like, the difference between a Tiquan Yin oolong versus an Ali Shang oolong or a monkey-picked oolong. So, I guess – maybe a little bit in there, but yeah.
I mean, like you mentioned those, and those are like such vastly different experiences for me personally.
Like, I was going to say like the difference between a Pu'er and a green jasmine. It's like, that's it's so different,
but I'm glad you have that kind of framework because you can, with tea, it's like actively cultivated in the tea to like, okay, we want this tea to make this person feel this way and have this. With herbs, I feel like, it could be, but it's not always.
It's more like we're discovering what's there instead of somebody tried to create. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's really cool because you can discover it, I think. And like visiting the farm and seeing how the things grow and tasting the herbs they just grew compared to the, sometimes like I'll forage for herbs and I'll be like, I just discovered the other day I have jamingzi growing next to my house, just like a weed. It's really pretty. I didn't end up harvesting it because I couldn't find instructions. And the thing is with, I don't want to risk poisoning myself because I have a new kid. I have a baby. I don't have time for that. I have a practice. I find it really interesting to like taste and see like, how is that different than that? And like the doujong that I get sometimes, like the doujong I had in class was quite different than this. And like the colors between our two, like what you have and I have. And this was just 3 cups boiled on high heat. 25 minutes, just the same as yours. Like it can be, it's kind of different things. And so they're going to probably do different things. Like even if you just think chemically, it's going to be different if they look and taste different. Anyway, I'd be curious, like after this conversation, if it ends up in any way influencing anything you teach, since you are teaching a lot of first year students.
No, I'll have to think about that. And like, especially because even the class I taught this semester was online. And so it's like I'm doing a lot of online stuff. And so that was something I really missed about even just teaching this class at PCOM was we couldn't do that herb tasting that I normally do where it's like, oh, I'm going to sometimes, like I said, bring in these muffins with all five flavors and then we can taste some formulas and then we can even do like some food therapy, like get some black sesame and walnut with honey sort of thing and taste a different thing. So
and then you'll just shout the Huang Nian Zhi Tang without telling them what it is.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, everybody, take a shot of this.
Try it. Yeah. So I miss that there was that aspect. So I'm trying to think of like how that can be more incorporated. And again, part of it is just to make herbs more exciting because I feel like teaching herbs is an uphill battle because most people, first of all, it's like, it's not what they signed up for.
I went to acupuncture school. Few people say I went to herbal school.
I think in New York it's optional or in some of the places it's optional, but in California it's like in order to be a licensed acupuncturist, there's only one test and it has an herbal portion. So you have to take herbs. And so a lot of people are just like, oh, I just want to do sports medicine and I don't want to have to do this stuff. And so it's already an uphill battle. It's already difficult because it's a lot of Chinese, it's a lot of pinyin, and it's a lot of just memorizing functions that when you present it in class, it's words on a page. And it's not the same as like an acupuncture class where there's the practical section where you're locating the points or you're drawing the pathways of the channel with mascara or whatever. It's like all you have is words on a page. And so it would be nice to be able to incorporate that, but especially as more and more is going online, I think it's going to be more and more of a challenge to get that across.
Check out that free resource that I mentioned that Julianne did. Cause she, like what she does is like 10 to 20 minute videos where she just like brews the herbs, tells you how she brews it, tastes it, and then, you know, invites you to follow along. And I think it's really cool.
Because that sounds really fun.
I think it's a really not unique, but it's like, it's a way to learn herbs that like really makes it like exactly how you're saying, where you can actually interact with them. You have a relationship. And I'm sure there are plenty of people who actually want to learn herbs, but like I've met some folks who have asked me like, I want to learn herbs, but I don't want to learn acupuncture. What can I do? And I'm like, unfortunately you have to learn acupuncture.
And I mean, you say it's not unique, but I think for like the school experience that most people had, it is unique. Well, I was flabbergasted when I had people who like they got to the intern level and they had never taken herbs. Like that's part of the reason I started doing it in the intro and herbs one classes, because a lot of people, I was seeing people in clinic who had never taken herbs any time in their life.
Well, yeah, I guess not unique. I mean, it's not like a new thought because like literally the forefather Shennong. Of herbs, Shennong, this is how he learned it. But unfortunately, it's not learned that way now.
Yeah, and I think it would be cool like if you could put together a little kit where like maybe it was just even like the 20 most common herbs. Mm-hmm. And so it's like you get 15 to 20 grams of each herb and then you can cook them and follow along and taste them and kind of like, I don't know, I guess like when you go to a bar and have a beer flight, you could like have an at-home herb flight of the different herbs, but you'd have someone guiding you about what you should be looking for and the taste and stuff like that. I feel like that would be an interesting thing to do.
That could be a fun business, little mini business. I don't know. If you don't run with it, let me know.